'Tis the season to be wary. The hurricane months are here. So is another above normal storms forecast and above normal insurance and emergency management anxieties. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll say hello to another hurricane season. Forecasters, the ones still employed, again expect an above-average roster of named storms, from Andrea to Wendy, including as many as 5 major hurricanes. But here are 2 big questions if one of them hits us. Will your overpriced windstorm policy actually cover the damage anymore? And with FEMA funding and staffing on the ropes, what will storm response look like in storm-prone places like the Keys? All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. And since we're speaking a little Spanish, Creole, and Portuguese, let's recall the word for hurricane in all those South Florida languages. Huracán, ciclón, furacao. I really like that last one. But of course, like you, I don't like hurricanes. Still, starting on Sunday, we have no choice here but to deal with these tropical storms for the next 6 months. So we're dedicating this week's show to hurricane season preparation, which is admittedly more challenging this year considering how many federal weather scientists and experts have lost their jobs in recent months, how bad Florida's Cat 5 insurance storm has become, and now the uncertain future of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. How is that going to affect hurricane hotspots like the Keys? But first, we're going to dive like one of those Hurricane Hunter aircraft into the storm forecast for this Atlantic hurricane season, or I should say for yet another above-average storm season. Are you prepared for hurricane season? Let us know what concerns you most. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now, we're very fortunate to have 2 top hurricane experts to help us look at the season ahead. Jamie Rome is Deputy Director of the National Hurricane Center here in Miami, run, of course, by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. And Haijian Jiang is an Earth and Environmental Professor at Florida International University. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Jamie Rome, as I mentioned, NOAA is anticipating as many as 19 named storms this year, well above the average of 14, and as many as 5 could be major, meaning Category 3 or higher, or wind speeds of 111 miles per hour or higher. Tell us more, Jamie, about the 2025 forecast. What you find is most important in that?
Well, it's still early in the process, early in the season, and our ability to sort of say with certainty, you know, who might experience hurricane conditions this year is limited.
Sure.
So what the forecast is telling you is the overall activity across the entire basin for 6 months, but it doesn't tell you whether storms might form or how strong they would be.
Sure.
And et cetera. So, you know, we really have to get a little deeper into the hurricane season, say July or August, to kind of start to know specifically how those named storms might materialize. Mm-hmm.
But aside from just the numbers here, what else stands out to you in terms of what could lie ahead for this season? Anything unusual or striking that we should perhaps be keeping in mind?
Well, we've been in this active era for the last 10 years or so.
Yeah.
Hurricanes they tend to come in batches over the course of many years, dozens of years, right? So we're in a sort of an active period, and we've been in a period where ocean temperatures are quite warm, and they remain warm so far this hurricane season. And those two things would generally portend an active year, another active year.
Now, we know that our ability to precisely forecast individual storms, where they'll go and when, how strong they'll be, etc., has improved dramatically, Jamie, but how has our ability to accurately forecast entire hurricane seasons improved in recent years?
You know, there's still a lot there that we have to work on. You know, ideally we would get to a place where we could, you know, answer the question that everybody's wanting to know, will they be impacted? And right now the science doesn't let you get there. I was sort of talking to someone earlier, is meteorologists are always struggling with that which the public is most interested in is always just beyond the reach of predictability.
Yeah.
You know, and that's sort of where we are with seasonal forecast. You know, we can sort of look at general trends, but the ability to say whether or not Florida residents are going to be impacted, we just don't have that ability.
And you mentioned warming oceans. What are the major meteorological and environmental factors, Jamie, that are driving these predictions this time around in 2025?
So, the ones people most are familiar with, the presence of El Nino or La Nina in the East Pacific and ocean temperatures, they're only two of about, you know, 5 to 10 factors that go into the seasonal prediction. Now, they happen to be two of the stronger or more dominant, you know, drivers, but there's other things like, you know, the weather patterns over the North Atlantic Ocean, the presence of dry air over the
right.
tropical Atlantic. There's just a whole host of things that go into this, the how strong these tropical waves coming off Africa, which are the seedlings for future hurricanes, you know, how strong are they?
Right.
There's just a whole, you know, number of factors that come together.
And factors like El Nino and La Nina still play a role, no?
Oh, absolutely. They're probably the two of the larger, but they're not the only ones. And that's what leads to the unpredictability aspect. If it were just La Nina and sea surface temperatures, predicting the seasonal, making the seasonal forecast would be relatively easy, but there are other factors too.
Right. Haijian Jiang, I know one of your focuses is hurricane intensity. In fact, you've helped develop satellite-based databases to study that. Given the conditions Jamie Rome just laid out, and given that the forecast is for an above-average number of major storms again this year, what are you anticipating in terms of how strong and how wet this season's storms could be?
I echo Jamie's answer. There are lots of uncertainties about that. However, in general, I anticipate that we might see some very intense storms because the current ocean and atmospheric conditions seems unfavorable based on the long-term outlook, although there are some uncertainties. Mm-hmm. They are favorable to storm development and intensification. These conditions include warmer than average ocean temperatures, lower vertical wind shear, and stronger Western Africa monsoon season.
Right. And excuse me, Haijian, can you explain to people why that wind shear factor is so important, particularly when we talk about Atlantic hurricanes?
Yeah, the wind shear. So if we have a stronger vertical wind shear, the wind will destroy the hurricane development.
Right. Sort of decapitates them, right?
Right, right. So if there is a lower wind shear, it allows the storms to develop without disruption.
Right. And remind us, Haijian, how large a role climate change and global warming are playing in raising the intensity of these storms. I know, for example, that there is a big concern that because the Gulf is so much warmer today compared to other bodies of water, the Florida Gulf Coast has become exponentially more vulnerable recently to more intense and more quickly intensifying storms than, say, we can expect here on the Atlantic coast. Is that accurate?
In the past 30 to 40 years, we have seen that hurricane rainfall intensity, hurricane resident time near the coast, and the intensity of major hurricanes have all been increasing. These are the facts we see, and sometimes some scientists conclude that they are a result of climate change.
Right.
However, we do not have definitive proof of this conclusion.
Right.
And we know that other factors may contribute to these trends, including multi-decadal variability, like the warmer ocean temperature we see.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what that term that you just mentioned, explain for our listeners what that means.
You mean the multi-decadal variability?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we are in the climate state, right? Sometime the climate will change. So
right.
When we say global warming, it's a unique increasing of ocean temperatures. However, if we say multi-decadal variability, that means maybe in the past 10 years or 20 years, the temperature is increasing, but then we'll see decreasing.
Okay.
For example, right now in the West Pacific, we see an inactive season for the past few years, but we do see more active in the Atlantic. So that's part of the multi instability.
And I should mention, your early education was in China, so you know as much about the Pacific and typhoons and that phenomenon as you do about the Atlantic and hurricanes, no?
When I was in China, I didn't study specifically for tropical cyclones. So my education started in University of Utah. I started to study hurricanes. So,
and Jamie Rome, this idea of you know, warmer temperatures, et cetera, as factors, could that also mean we should get used to seeing actual hurricanes coming out of the gate earlier in the season, which was, for example, the case last year, no?
You know, it's one of the things that's been talked about, and it was talked about so much. If you remember a couple of years ago, there was discussion of hurricane season starting sooner. But we haven't had a system form prior to June 1 for the last 4 years. So this sort of speaks to your hurricane activity comes in waves. Like you could have a couple seasons in a row where you have early starts,
yeah,
and then you could have a couple seasons in a row where you have late starts. Thankfully we've had late starts for the last couple of seasons.
Yeah, 2017 with Irma was kind of a wake up call to us about, you know, after we had thought that we were out of the woods after 2004 and 2005, right?
Yeah, so and that's another good point. So some seasons are front loaded, meaning most of the activity occurs on the front end, and then you get an abrupt stop to the hurricane season in fall. And some seasons are loaded towards the back, meaning you don't get much of any activity in June or July, but then you get a whole flurry of activity in the latter part of the summer and fall.
And Jamie, I wanted to ask you too that same question I put to Hajan, to weigh in on that climate change factor. The World Meteorological Organization, for example, just issued a warning that the next 5 years could be among the hottest on record on this planet. So how is that changing the way you and agencies like yours build hurricane season forecast models?
Well, you know, all of our modeling, whether it be seasonal forecast or real-time hurricane predictions, you know what's happening in the atmosphere at present. So if the globe warms or is warming, it would... our predictions know that already.
Okay. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Jamie Rome of the National Hurricane Center and Haijian Jiang of Florida International University about the expected above-average hurricane season starting this weekend. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Jamie Rome, I also wanted to pivot a little here to how the recent cuts we've seen at federal agencies like yours, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, stand to affect the work of the National Hurricane Center and other agencies when it comes to monitoring and preparing us for the storms to come this year. We've seen about 1,000 layoffs at NOAA so far this year. And there's a concern that routine work, like sending out weather balloons and hurricane hunter flights, could be impacted. Do you and your colleagues anticipate that your efforts could be compromised at all?
There are a couple things here that I can put people's minds at ease. You know, we have sufficient staffing to have people around the clock for every operational shift this hurricane season. So,
okay.
You know, we don't anticipate that's going to be a problem. And we've always had the ability... And we'll, you know, continue to have the ability to augment observations as needed. So we can do a couple things. We can request what we call supplemental balloon launches, which means we would put a call out to our offices to try to launch more balloons. And then we have the aircraft, which we can deploy as needed. And we've always used the aircraft to strategically fill gaps in observations. And so, you know, we can deploy the aircraft, you know, strategically as we need to, based off any, holes in the observations, if you will.
Okay.
We're ready here at the Hurricane Center. The staff is ready here at the Hurricane Center. You know, I can put your mind at ease on that one.
Okay. Haijian Jiang, let me put that same question to you. I know you're not part of the federal government, but as a climate scholar, I know your work often intersects with and has been funded by agencies like NOAA. So are you concerned that cuts like these put our ability to forecast storms and advise the public in the timely manner we've become used to?
Personally, I have not experienced any impact to my research. The United States is the leading country on hurricane research, and the federal government is an important partner in this work. So I hope they continue to support our talented researchers and students to help us advance the research in hurricanes.
Jamie Rome, I know one of the big concerns we saw last year in Florida was the number of tornadoes we saw spun off of hurricanes. I believe 46 of them from Hurricane Milton alone. And I know that another big concern in turn is that funding cuts could affect the ability of local agencies to warn folks about those hurricane-related twisters. How is that being addressed?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, some storms produce more tornadoes than others. There's still a lot of research into, why some produce more than others. And we partner with our sister office, Storm Prediction Center, to incorporate their expertise into our forecast and messaging. So, people know them from their work this time of year on severe weather, but what people might not know is how much they work with us during hurricane season to incorporate that same level of expertise
Right.
in predictions into our messaging.
And Jamie, what is our best understanding of why we're seeing more hurricanes spin off more tornadoes these days?
It's sort of how they interact with the broader pattern. In some cases they're interacting with a larger scale weather features, what we would call like a trough of low pressure that would come down and pick it up and sort of steer it north or push it one way or the other. Some hurricanes interact with those in a way that bring that energy sort of down to the surface and produce those tornadoes.
Haijian Jiang, I want to end here with you and a subject that's getting more and more attention these days when we talk about hurricanes and hurricane strength. Again, your specialty, and that's dust. That is dust clouds from the Sahara Desert floating over here and helping to hinder hurricane formation because they tend to keep ocean temperatures a bit cooler, as I understand. Meteorologists say we've got some of that dust heading our way right now. So could that possibly lighten the coming hurricane season at all?
There are lots of uncertainties on the Saharan air layer research and their impact on hurricane intensity. Right now, our understanding is only when the dust get involved really to the inner core, to the center, and around the center of the hurricane, that then the dust will have negative impact. However, sometimes the dust just be around and maybe promote hurricane development.
Ah,
So
okay.
there are lots of uncertainties going on. So I
Okay.
encourage people still
So
watch the.
it can work both ways. We shouldn't take dust as some reason to be complacent then about
Right,
it.
right, right.
Exactly.
Not the a very definitive factor.
Haijian Jiang is an earth and environmental professor at Florida International University. Jamie Rome is deputy director of NOAA's National Hurricane Center in Miami. Many thanks to you both. We appreciate it.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.
Still to come, what you likely don't know but should about your really expensive Florida windstorm policy. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Paget. If you're like me, you get a tad impatient every time you hear someone in Florida crow about having no state income tax. We do, in fact, have a de facto state income tax. It's called property insurance. Floridians pay triple the national average to insure their homes, and in recent years, as hurricanes and especially the flooding they bring get more and more intense, more and more questions have arisen about whether our exorbitant policies will really cover what we've been led to believe they do. And at no time of the year should we be raising those questions more seriously than now, the start of a new hurricane season. As more Floridians try to reduce their premiums by raising their deductibles, for example, do they really understand how that affects what they, and not the insurance company, will be on the hook for after the next Cat 3 storm plows through? And do we really understand how those insurance companies operate now, even when they're actually on the hook for storm damage? What are your questions or experiences in that regard? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to look at those questions and more is Joshua Connor. He is a licensed public adjuster. That means the intermediary between the insurance policyholder and the insurance company when a claim like storm damage is made. And he's a founder of the Pompano Beach adjusters firm, Coastal Claim Consultants. He's also a critic of the Florida insurance industry. Joshua Connor, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
First, remind our listeners exactly what an insurance adjuster is and does, Joshua.
Yeah, absolutely. There's actually three different types of adjusters that you can encounter if you file an insurance claim. There's a staff adjuster, an independent adjuster, and a public adjuster. Mm-hmm. The first two adjusters, staff adjusters and independent adjusters, actually work directly for insurance companies. And the independent adjusters in particular often get mistaken for representing the policyholder. So there is definitely some clarity to be had there just with the moving parts and the parties involved in a claims process.
No, I'm glad you brought that. That is good clarity. Thank you. And then the third type of adjuster you were referring to?
Right. That's actually what I am, a public insurance adjuster. And so we solely represent policyholders on their behalf and prepare and present their claim to the insurance company.
Okay. So the work of an adjuster, you know, in my layman's understanding, seems to put you in the position of understanding where both the property insurance companies and the insurance policyholders are coming from. You're sort of able to put yourself in both pairs of shoes, as it were. So in a recent South Florida Sun Sentinel op-ed, Joshua, you as an adjuster put forth that homeowners insurance, at least in this state, is no longer the, quote, safety net it once was. To start here, before we get into the more detailed factors you lay out, just tell us in general terms why you say that.
Well, I've been in the industry for 25 years on the claims handling side. The first decade of my career was as an insurance company adjuster. And I've watched policies change over that time frame pretty significantly and drastically, even in the last 5 years, where coverages that were normally afforded under a policy, you know, were modified, revised, and reduced almost completely out of policies. And we've kind of coined terms for it because it is such a common thing of shrinkflation and illusory coverage. You know, a great example would be a client that we had that suffered damage from a tornado in Vero Beach after the last hurricane that was very proud at the time to announce that they had secured an endorsement for screen enclosure coverage because they had suffered damage to their screen enclosure. Mm-hmm. Well, as we reviewed the endorsement, we actually found out that the frame was covered, but the actual screens were not. And unfortunately, about 90% of the damage to the enclosure was the screen. So that's where we talk about illusory coverage, where even if you are able to add certain things back, it might not be exactly what you think it is or what you thought that you paid for.
Okay, so in your Sun Sentinel op-ed, you cite three major trends homeowners should watch for this hurricane season. And the first two have to do with the insurance companies and how they operate. What are those two trends?
Absolutely. And that's specifically in terms of a catastrophe loss. So, you know, when you have daily claims, you know, pipe breaks, fire losses, it's a little bit of a different category. But when you have large loss events like a hurricane, there's just too many claims for insurance companies, staff adjusters to handle. So they bring in third-party adjusting company, insurance adjusters, we call those TPAs. And, you know, the goal of those companies is to get these adjusters in to look at homes as many as possible, as fast as possible. And address those losses. And obviously the attention to detail isn't necessarily there when that's the case. So you have people that might not even be from, you know, your
state
or your area.
Right, you point out that a lot of these people are, quote, outsiders who don't know the ins and outs of the Florida scenario, right?
Exactly. They don't understand, you know, the laws of our state. They don't understand the construction of our building materials. So it's nearly impossible to get it 100% accurate, especially when they're moving with expediency to get to the next house as well.
And the second trend you cite has to do with what you call claim reassignment.
Yeah, and that's a very much a newer trend that we're seeing. So, you know, to understand kind of why this is happening, it's multifaceted, but the insurance companies want to get these claims looked at, paid, and closed as soon as possible. But once those claims are closed, to get them reopened, if you have, you know, additional concerns or damages, the file gets reassigned to a new examiner or desk adjuster. That individual needs several days to review it, may have a completely different chart to course for the claim. And we're seeing that happen multiple times on claims where, you know, each time it gets reassigned, it may be a week delay just in that reassignment. So if you have three desk adjusters assigned to a claim, you're talking weeks and weeks and weeks just for them to evaluate the claim, determine a new course for the claim, maybe bring in other third parties to review the claim. And so it's become this quite repetitive cycle that homeowners get, they get trapped in, and they're not really sure how to move a claim forward. And that's one of our biggest concerns lately.
And as you said, these trends like claims outsourcing and reassignment, you feel these are relatively new on the scene here in Florida, these trends?
It's becoming more prevalent. Insurance companies, I would say about a decade ago, really started to shift towards third-party entities to assist in adjusting claims. COVID definitely expedited a lot of that as well, in terms of the actual staff adjusters and desk examiners. But it is absolutely something where we're even seeing more virtual inspections now. A lot of insurance companies have apps that they'll have the client walk through their property and show them a video, and they'll make a claim determination from that. So,
or drones get used, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. They're implementing a lot of technology, which as of yet, I can't honestly say that that's improving the process at all.
Okay. Now, the third important trend you cite has to do with us, the policyholders, and the attention we may not be paying to what our policies do and do not cover, especially after we've done things like raise our deductibles so we can lower our premiums. What concerns you the most about this minefield?
Yeah, and you know, the old analogy, you get what you pay for. You know, you think with an increased premium, you'd have better coverage, but we're seeing absolutely the opposite of that right now. And a lot of those, you know, endorsements or exclusions that are being applied to policies, you know, clients aren't looking for those. They're looking at the number. They're not looking at the coverage. So I would encourage every homeowner, every policyholder to really get with their agent, especially the endorsements and exclusions on a policy. Mm-hmm. And you'll find those on your policy declarations page. Really understand those, read those. Like we said, you might have screen enclosure coverage, but it might only cover the frame and not the screen.
Right.
So very likely there's some illusory coverage out there. Water exclusions, another predominant thing. There's just so many things being redacted from policies that I you know, encourage you, because once the loss happens, obviously you can't go back and change that.
And Joshua,
hindsight's always 20/20.
Joshua, concerning premium costs, a complaint I often hear from friends is, why can't the policyholder, the consumer really, set the home rebuilding cost in these policies, which the companies often seem to inflate, but which seems such a decisive factor in setting the premium cost?
It's absolutely something that you can address, because I did that on my own home. I live in South Florida, and when I purchased my home, the value they wanted to set to that was the actual mortgage value, which obviously included the amount of the land that I purchased, not the building itself. So I actually did get with my agent, discussed that. We presented an alternative number to my insurance company, and they actually accepted that.
Okay.
For my policy premium amount, and my premium was reduced. So
right.
You're onto
so,
something there.
So be vigilant about that. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Pompano Beach insurance adjuster Joshua Connor about the frustrating challenges Florida policyholders face as we enter a new hurricane season. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. So Joshua, in a recent report by WPTV Channel 5 up in West Palm Beach, you asserted that Floridians are seeing the, quote, absolute erosion of their property and windstorm insurance policies. You also estimate the possibility of an insurance company getting a claim right to be a pretty disappointing 3%. So what are you basing that pretty critical assessment on?
You know, a lot of the factors that we just discussed, and particularly with catastrophe claims, the speed at which the adjusters move, the lack of, you know, training and education, and the reliance on, you know, technology that, you know, can't fill a shingle, it can't, lift a tile. The ability for the insurance company to get those claims right, and it's really not even the intent. And I say that from working for them for over a decade. You want to get it as right as you can, but I was trained even to let people know, hey, the supplemental process is probably where this is going to end up. And that was for a decade, I was told that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I don't even know that the intent is necessarily to get it 100% right from the start.
Okay, so and again, to be fair, the insurance companies and insurance agencies suggest the situation isn't as bad as critics like yourself say. In that same WPTV report, for example, an agent from, I believe, Lantana asserted that policy claims issues are still, in his words, relatively small, and that policy coverage and affordability in Florida is actually improving. That the coverage is actually expanding here, not shrinking. And a lot of Florida state legislators seem to agree. Is this an overly optimistic assessment in your view?
I believe it is. And, just because they're going to cover a 30-year-old roof doesn't mean they're going to apply some incredibly restrictive, provisions to that. There's things called roof depreciation schedules
Sure.
where they may cover a 30-year-old roof, but they may only cover 25% of it if they actually pay for it. So again, read your policy, understand your endorsements. I see the actual application of it on the ground when a claim occurs. So yes, it's great that they may be covering more things, but what are they actually covering is my question.
And in fact, a Senate subcommittee hearing this month in Washington, insurance adjusters there from Florida and the U.S. Southeast testified that they were pressured by insurance companies to alter the work they'd done to determine claims payouts last year after major hurricanes like Helene and Milton to lower those payouts. If an adjuster resists this pressure, one of them testified, quote, "The claim is reassigned to someone who complies." This seems to harken back to the claims reassignment trend you cited earlier. How bad was this phenomenon here in Florida last year after those hurricanes I just mentioned?
It's tough for me to say because I work on the other side. But in the decade that I work for insurance companies, sad to say that that is a common occurrence, but it's almost so common that you don't even see it as a negative thing. Because it is just the norm on that side, especially working as an independent adjuster, you're easily disposable, right? And so that definitely was something that I was aware of, even working for the insurance companies. And honestly, it's created the disparity. And I encourage people to look at the amount of Department of Financial Services complaints from consumers,
Yeah.
if you truly want to see the state of the market.
And along those lines, Joshua, then what are your major do's and don'ts for homeowners now after a hurricane hits them?
Well, I think it always starts before, to be honest with you. So you want to know your policy, you want to know your coverages, and make sure they actually apply. That's the biggest thing. And then hardening your home, anything that you can do to protect your property, and then to document that prior to a storm occurring. One of the big debates after storm is what did the storm actually damage, or what may have been there prior to that? Well, if you document the state of your property on the outside and the inside prior to a loss occurring, that's your best chance to be able to justify any damage that does occur after the event.
And like if you get impact windows, for example, let the company know, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Any hardening improvements, definitely let them know. You might get discounts on your premium.
Right. So, Joshua, in the bigger picture, what are the remedies here? What more does the Florida state legislature have to do at this point in your mind to make the property insurance playing field more level for the consumer and more inviting for more insurance companies to play on that field in the first place, so we don't see what you've called such a complex insurance ecosystem here?
Yeah, and it is a very complex situation. You want to encourage insurers to come to the state, but you need to protect consumers at the same time. And it 100% needs to be bipartisan, where both parties need to honestly sit down and try to figure it out. You hear a lot about litigation and issues with infringement on that, but at the same time, behind the scenes, I'm seeing policies being stripped of coverage, and that's not being talked about. The big headlines are fraud and litigation, but there's not going to be anything to litigate if there's nothing left to be covered in the policy at the end of the day. And so that's my biggest concern. You may reinstate some, provisions for litigation, but if there's nothing to sue for, even if they don't do right by you, nothing matters. So it's all about the policy and the coverages in the policy.
Good insight. Joshua Connor is a founder of the Pompano Beach insurance adjusters firm Coastal Claim Consultants. Joshua, many thanks.
Tim, my pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Still to come, what will emergency response look like this hurricane season in a hotspot like the Keys with FEMA on the ropes? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Paget. When you talk about hurricanes in South Florida, the first thing that comes to mind is the Keys. It's been the site of some of America's worst storm catastrophes, like the 1935 Labor Day hurricane that killed almost 500 people. It's also a favorite backdrop for famous hurricane movies, like the 1948 Humphrey Bogart classic, Key Largo.
My name is Frank McLeod. I'm about 12 miles off Boot Key Harbor on my way in. Over.
Hold your course. And so the Florida Keys, also known as Monroe County, are also a focal point of hurricane response in South Florida. And right now, that raises the issue of the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. A third of FEMA's full-time staff has been let go, and a third of its budget is on the chopping block. The administration says more of FEMA's efforts should actually devolve to state and local governments, and Florida officials like Governor Ron DeSantis agree. What do you think? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to ponder the current emergency management landscape is Monroe County's new interim emergency management director, Corey Suiso. Thanks for being with us, Corey.
Hey, thanks for having me, and hello from sunny, beautiful Florida Keys.
Well, it's pretty sunny here in Miami, too, but but it's great to have you with us on this eve of the hurricane season. Now, you had been Monroe County's deputy emergency management director. You're taking over for Shannon Weiner, who's taking a position at the University of Tampa, as we understand, and you come from a military background. For example, you were the emergency manager at the Key West Naval Air Station when Category 4 Hurricane Irma hammered the Keys back in 2017. The role of directing emergency management in the Keys, the most storm-vulnerable corner of this country, almost seems to require a military mindset, does it not?
Oh, absolutely. There is quite a bit of planning and coordinating. You know, we pride ourselves down here in the Keys as a community that is extremely resilient. We are a community that relies on one another, and we are dependent on that coordination piece between our different partners. And that could be from, you know, our local law enforcement, our municipalities, all the way to the National Hurricane Center and the National Weather Station down here in Key West.
Now, let's go back to Hurricane Irma in 2017. What did that storm tell you about how much stronger and wetter hurricanes are becoming in the age of climate change and global warming, and what vicinities like the Keys need to do to adjust to that?
Yeah, down here in the Keys, we're extremely vulnerable. Like for other places in Florida, you could be like, okay, we're only vulnerable to Gulf storms. But hey, guess what? Down here in the Keys, we have the Atlantic on one side, and we have the Gulf on the other.
Right, that's a good point. You get both of it. Yeah.
You know, and we saw that this year. You know, you see some storms. You have some activity out in the Atlantic, but you also saw a lot of strong storms this last year come from the Gulf. So you really need to be prepared. And Irma kind of showed you that. If you watched the track during Irma. You know, was flirting with, hey, it may go north prior to Florida.
Yeah.
But as you saw Irma creep along, that storm progressively got a little bit further west. And then, you know, everyone knows what happened from there. Took the turn straight up the Keys. But we push storm surge down here. You can hide from wind, but yeah. In the Keys, we're all in the flood zone. And if you think that a storm surge is just a bathtub filling a bathtub with water, it is violent. That water comes in extremely violent. And guess what? When it leaves just as violent. And it's going to take everything with you. So
right. You
really push. Hey, take the warning and evacuate when you can.
But I'm glad you mentioned the Gulf, because those waters are getting exponentially hotter. Does that mean that you're actually having to look out at the Gulf perhaps a lot more intensely than emergency management directors in the Keys had to in decades past?
Well, normally you follow some trends. Early on in the year, we start seeing some storms coming from the Atlantic side. And then you start seeing some transition towards, you know, that September, October timeframe, and you start getting some storms coming up from the south. But we are on the ready 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have a phenomenal partnership with the National Weather Station down here in the Keys. They provide us with outstanding forecasting and then timely updates when we do have active storms in the area.
But what concerns you most about this coming hurricane season, especially when you look at the above average forecast for storms? And so what would you tell people, not just in the Keys, but all over Florida, to start doing now to prepare for it?
You need to have a plan. You know, storms can pop up very quickly. You look at Helene popping up, you know, in the south where Irma, you had a
now,
full...
Helene meaning the major hurricane that hit last year, right?
Correct. But you looked at like Hurricane Irma. It was like, I always use the joke, it's like a Zamboni coming across the ice. You know, it was slow. It was coming. We had 7, 8 days to look at it. But we need to have a plan now. And it's not just your plan, is your family's plan. What kind of items are you evacuating with? What do you need to come back into the area after you evacuate? And having that sense of preparedness throughout the entire hurricane season is going to make that decision-making process a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, you've got some new tools in your box this year, though, right? I mean, Monroe County has a brand new emergency operations center and even a new water desalination plant. Tell us more about those new features and why they're so important for the Keys moving into future and likely stronger hurricane seasons.
Yeah, our brand new emergency operations center, this thing is a gem down here, and it's been long overdue. We are over 20 feet above ground, and we're self-sustaining for 72 hours for about 150 people. We have food, we have drinking water, electrical power, wastewater storage, and we were one of the last counties in the state of Florida to have a standalone EOC. Like in Irma, we had to actually evacuate north and then wait for the storm to pass and then come back to do a recovery response. Right. Now I can have my entire team stationed ready to go as soon as the storm passes. We're ready to respond and recover.
And what about that hurricane evacuation for the 80,000 Keys residents, though? I know the evacuation infrastructure and logistics there have been an issue recently in Monroe County as well. What's the update on that? And again, what is the most important message you want to send folks there and anywhere about evacuation?
I'm going to keep stressing preparedness. Down here in the Keys, we have one road in and we have one road down.
Exactly, yeah.
So we have our challenges. Our residents and our tourists need to understand not every storm is exactly the same. Some are going to be bigger, some are going to be faster. Where is that track going to take you? So we need to make sure our residents know that when we order an evacuation, we're going to do that in enough time where we can safely evacuate the county before we have tropical storm force winds. And that's about 35 miles per hour. Because once you start getting into that 35 mile an hour sustained winds, now we're concerned about those high profile vehicles.
Yeah.
You know, now we're worried about some bridges. So we want to get that warning out as quickly as possible. And when we issue that evacuation order, we need people to take that order and move as quickly as they possibly can. But we're going to do it orderly.
Don't wait. Yeah. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Corey Suiso, the new interim emergency management director for Monroe County and the Keys, about a potentially more complicated hurricane response situation this year. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Now, Corey, as I mentioned at the outset, one of the other big potential challenges for local emergency management in places like the Keys this hurricane season are the funding and staff cuts, real and proposed, at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. When we talk about a third of FEMA's full-time staffing already being eliminated this year, how does that likely reduction in federal disaster assistance impact how a local emergency management director like yourself prepares?
Well, the jury's kind of still out there. We're you know, patiently waiting to see what the final verdict is on the funding changes. But you know, our county as a whole and our emergency management team, we're going into the season you know, as normal. Like, we're a normal business. We haven't seen any of those cuts right now. Our National Weather Service partners and our National Hurricane Center are going into the same the season, you know, same status as last year. They haven't seen the cuts yet down here. So we are moving forward, status quo.
Yeah,
But we are.
and I should point out, Congress does not seem as eager to dismantle FEMA as the Trump administration does. So
Right.
yeah, so that probably gives you a little better feeling as well, no?
Right. Yeah. And you know, we're ready to make any changes to our policies that we need to, and we feel confident that we're going to be able to continue to keep our residents and our tourists safe down here in the Keys.
Now, Governor DeSantis has said he actually welcomes the FEMA cuts because he feels states like Florida have always viewed FEMA as an almost unnecessary agency. He says state and local government can handle things after a hurricane just fine by themselves, thank you. But what's right and wrong about the governor's assertion? I mean, to say that FEMA is really an unnecessary entity in a disaster situation for local and state government seems a little bit of a stretch, no?
We have a great relationship with the Florida Division of Emergency Management. We have and we continue to coordinate very, very well with them. And in the past incidents, we've had a great relationship with FEMA. So, you know, down here in the Keys, we don't see, you know, much concern about any of the changes. We have good working relationships with both our state and federal partners, and we're looking forward to a slow season, but we're going to make sure we do everything we can to keep these residents safe.
And to help people understand, Corey, you know, when we talk about FEMA and the federal input on disaster response, what is it that we can say the federal, you know, they have always said, look, we're only there when we're called upon by state and local governments. When they are called upon, what is it that the federal response brings to the disaster response that's important?
Yeah, they've come down in the past with, you know, public and individual assistance to our residents. So we haven't seen any changes to what that plan is for us down here in the Keys. And you know, we're looking forward to any changes, and we'll adjust as we see fit.
And what about the equally controversial cuts we're seeing at federal agencies like the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, whose forecasters and scientists keep emergency management directors like you informed in advance? Your predecessor, Shannon Weiner, said this month she's confident those cuts won't, for example, affect the important field offices in the Keys. Do you feel you'll have everything you and the Keys need from that camp this year?
Yeah, absolutely. Just got off the phone, got off a call with Dr. Brennan from the National Hurricane Center yesterday. They are fully ready and fully staffed to handle all of the hurricane demands this year. And then our field office down here in Key West at the National Weather Service, they are fully manned, fully ready to go, and providing us updates, you know, as we speak. So you know, we've seen a lot of the cuts, but it has not affected us down here in the Keys.
So in the end then, Corey, in just the minute we have left here, what is your biggest your biggest preparation assignment, should we say, at this point at the beginning of the hurricane season? What are you all in the Keys doing at this point to really, make sure that if we do have an above average season, as they're saying, that this is not going to be, hazardous for people down there.
We are pushing public outreach and communication very, very strong down here. And I do want to give a little bit of a plug with WLRN. WLRN is going to be the host station for a new program. It's called Beacon. Beacon is a great tool. Our residents and community can actually download that app. And they can actually tune into either 91.5 or 91.3.
And that started yesterday. And thanks for bringing that up. We'll have to leave it there. Corey Suiso is Monroe County's new interim emergency management director. Corey, many thanks and best of luck this year.
Thank you. Stay safe, everyone.
Thanks. Finally, on the roundup, as we have been stressing on today's program, this is the time to prepare for the 6-month-long hurricane season that kicks off on Sunday. The time to get your emergency kit ready, those flashlight batteries, for example, to stock up on non-perishable food items, and to check on loved ones, especially the elderly. Heather Hackett is the founder and executive director of Local Relief. It's an app that bridges the gap between communities and vital resources during times of disaster.
first and foremost is if you don't have cell phone, if whatever, make sure you can contact the immediate people around you. And at the same time too, expand that network and try to talk to your friends, talk to your family and say, hey, let's put a system together.
With their mobility challenges, chronic health conditions, and the solitude they often deal with, Hackett says it's important that seniors in our community know what's out there to help them. Another good place to find those resources is our website, WLRN.org/hurricanes. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.